normally shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fishery science. If you haven't already, follow the podcast on Twitter at FisheriesPod or on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast. If you enjoy the show and would like to become a sponsor, please head on over to patreon.com and search The Fisheries Podcast. For as little as $1 a month, you can help out and receive a Fisheries Podcast sticker in the mail. We have preset levels, but you can also choose your level of sponsorship. Every dollar helps offset our costs. This is the Fisheries Podcast 67th episode, and it's going to be a little different from previous shows. The whole intention was to bring a smile to your faces and spend some time with some familiar voices during this time when we may not be interacting with a whole lot of other people. It was great fun putting this episode together and hearing all of your fantastic voices. We ended up having contributions from at least 12 different fisheries professionals. Thank you so much for putting yourselves and your kids out there like that. I would love to continue hearing your stories. So if something cool or gross happens to you in the field, if you have a major coding win or fieldwork fail, record it and email it to us. We might just stick it on a future show.
So I take pure joy in bad, corny dad jokes. They are my absolute favorite, so I figured I would share a couple of fun ones I found online to bring a laugh to your day, whether that laugh is at the jokes or at me, either way, as long as you're laughing. All right, enjoy. Why did the fish blush? Because it saw the ocean's bottom. How do you make an octopus laugh? With tentacles. You'll hear me chuckling at my own jokes, don't worry. So this gar goes into a bar and the bartender asks, why the long face? Why don't fish pass their exams? Because they work below sea level. What does the Loch Ness Monster eat? Only fish and chips. What did the fish say when it swam into a concrete wall? Damn. The fish had a girlfriend, but he lobster. Then he flounder. What is a fish's favorite television show? 2.5 Men. Where do fish keep their money? In the riverbank. Two parrots are sitting on a perch. The first one says to the other, does something smell fishy? Get it? I don't always make fish puns, but when I do it just for the halibut. If you think of a better fish pun, let me know. Thank you all. I'll be here all quarantine if you want some more corny fish jokes. Stay safe.
Hello there, Fisheries Podcast. This is Sarah Alavainsa coming to you from lockdown in sunny Southampton, and I thought I would tell you my favourite fish-related story, in which I played a very small part, but a part nonetheless. So, back in my first year of undergrad, when I first came to Southampton, I started volunteering in the Discovery Collections, which are a natural history collection which is mostly deep sea specimens from the world's oceans. And it was a really cool opportunity. My job was mostly cataloguing, so I would note down what was in the collection so we could make a database and figure out what was there. Now, when Tammy Horton, who is the curator of the Discovery Collections, asked me what I wanted to catalogue first, for me, the answer had to be sharks. However, most of the shark and fish material from the Discovery Collections is actually housed at the Natural History Museum, not where I was in Southampton. So I said, okay, you know, that's fine. And I decided to catalogue the cephalopods instead, and went about very happily doing that. And one afternoon, when myself and a friend who'd joined me, we were hunting through the shelves, we stumbled upon a jar that was just labelled fish. And we thought, huh, that's interesting. So there were all these deep sea fish there, all these sort of usual suspects, your dragonfish, some lanternfish maybe, that sort of thing. So very interesting in themselves. But when we were looking at these fish, we saw inside there a lantern shark. And this was hugely exciting to us, and we went running around the mostly empty collections going, oh my god, we found a shark! And yeah, very fun moment. But after that, there were more and more sharks that were found in the Discovery collections, some by me, some by other people. And perhaps the best one someone found was a cookie cutter shark. Now, as a side note, cookie cutter sharks are my absolute favourite sharks in the world. They are the best sharks, they are the most interesting, and I will fight anyone on this topic. So if you want to debate me on that, just hit me up. But the cookie cutter shark in question, what makes this so cool, is that it was eventually featured on the British quiz show QI with Sandy Toksvig, among other panellists. But when Sandy revealed the cookie cutter shark to the panellists, comedian Alan Davies said, oh, I shut that out earlier. And despite my absolute love of Jonathan Creek, in which he plays the titular role, I have never ever forgiven him since. I will forever be offended that he called my favourite shark a turd. So yeah, I hope you're all well, and good luck surviving quarantine. Bye-bye.
I'm going to give a fieldwork fail. Typically, social media gets all the highlight reels, but you wish you might have gone into a different major some days. This one is my most recent field season. For my project, we had stream temperature monitors, some hobo loggers installed in your streams. You want to see how temperature changes and maybe relate that to whatever fish you have living there. So for me, especially for trout, stream temperature, super important. One of the crappy things about stream temperature monitors is that you have to go get them after the whole field season is done. You have to make sure it doesn't get washed away. And then you're just hoping that it's there when you get back to it. 140 streams, Northeast Iowa. So they're just sitting out in the stream. Now it's time for me to go get it. Day two of logger collection. And I started with loggers that were furthest away from our home base, and I figured I'd make up all these routes to make it really efficient, you know, how many we can do in a day, and trying to plan out, if I do this number per day, I can be done by October 1st or whenever deer season was going to start. Day two, had really high hopes. You know, we drive down to Clayton County and we're making really good progress. It was kind of rainy, but I was trying to knock out all the sites where you had to walk long distances. So, you know, we were moving, pretty good weather. And we get to the sixth site on the day where you had to go through the forest a little bit. And I figured, you know, the ground's kind of soft, but it's really flat. Plus, you get all these tree roots. They're going to soak up all the water, right? So we're driving back. And I was like, you know, I think we can get a little bit further. I think we can get a little bit further. You don't want to walk too much. You know, I want to get these loggers knocked out. Kind of come to the crest of this hill, and right at the bottom of the hill is the intersection where the trail meets the stream, and I knew that the logger was really close to the trail. So we're like, all right, we'll stop at the top of the hill. We don't want to get too far so that we can't get back up the hill. Put it in park, get all our tools, go down. Logger comes out easy, no rusted bolts from stream water. Get back to the truck, feeling good, put it in reverse. Nothing was moving. And we're like, Maybe put it in four. We're good. We'll put it in four. We'll be fine. Put it in four-wheel drive. No, there's nothing. Well, I'll try and get, you know, off the trail just a little bit. Tried that. Nothing. So like, you can't go any farther forward. Then you're on the other side of the hill. So at this point, I'm starting to get nervous. There's no winch. We try all the things that are easy to do. Try and shove a bunch of sticks and whatnot under the back tires, trying to get any traction. It's not happening. So we're like, all right, we just got to call someone from the DNR. They have plenty of trucks that can help us get out. They're going to laugh, but we need to get out of here. So we try a couple different offices, but it was getting close to 3 o'clock. And I believe it was Friday. No answers there. So we call one person that we knew would still be around. So he answers, luckily, on the second ring, and was like, okay, yeah, I got a couple things to do, but I can come down and help you out. Decora Fisheries Management had just gotten a brand new Ford F-350. It's huge. Super nice tires, 12,000-pound winch on the front. I was like, all right, we're saved. So we walk back to the gate, hanging out. About an hour passes, a couple more minutes after that. You know, we see the truck coming down the road, so we're like, all right, perfect. Man, this winch. that is going to rip this truck right out of these small ruts that we made, and we're going to be out of here on our way. So we hooked the winch up to the back of the truck. We're like feeling good. I get in the driver's seat, put it in reverse. I'm helping him out and not really going anywhere. And I was like, the winch on? Yeah, we're pulling. I see his tires in my rearview mirror slipping. Put it in park, get out. And he was like, all right, let me try it in four. No, nothing. Nobody's moving. If anything, we're both going slightly downhill. This is ideal. This is what you want. So we have a four-wheel drive truck that's stuck, hooked up to another four-wheel drive truck that's about twice the weight of it that's also stuck. And both trucks are nose first facing downhill. So we're like, okay, this might be bad. So he tries to unhook just so that he can potentially get one truck out. So we unhook the winch, try and get his truck back up the hill. Nothing. Even without the truck hooked up, can't get the new truck unstuck. So we spend the next 3 hours, that's 3 hours, slightly turning his truck with his winch by strapping it tree by tree by tree by tree and having to horizontally turn it back uphill. While he's doing that, the other TNR employee I worked with finds a crappy rope and was like, well, might as well try it once it's in forward to get both of these trucks out of here. He finds a good spot to tie the knot off onto the back of my truck and on the front of his truck. And wouldn't you know it, we spend an hour after that slowly inching our way with me in reverse and him pulling me out from front ways now all the way back up the hill. So about 5 hours after we think that we're on top of the world, we're going to get all these loggers done today, we're slowly rolling. I had to say I was a little worried about where the rest of my field season was going to go from there, but we got the work done, and I think we walked about twice as far as we normally would have at every site after that because I was so gun shy. But that is the story of the time that we managed to get two four-wheel drive trucks stuck when trying to get only one truck unstuck.
Field work.
Fun. That was just one of the worst field work days, and it's just burned into my memory. So
there's quite a few different days that are burned into my memory, but I thought that I would tell two different shark stories.
Baby shark doo 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 doo, baby shark doo 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 doo, baby shark doo 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 doo, baby shark.
So my first story, I was working in California. I worked at outdoor education camp. It was a tradition to go and buy a ton of chum and go into the San Pedro Channel, really deep, a couple thousand feet. And so you get like crazy pelagics coming through there all the time. What we do is on Easter Sunday in the morning before the sun came up, take a couple of boats and this massive amount of chum and just start chumming the water and just throw in all this dead fish and fish oil and everything into the water. And then we'd put on our wetsuits and our masks and snorkels, and we go snorkeling with whoever happened to show up. One year, no sharks showed up for a while. And we were like, that's pretty weird. And so one of my colleagues decided that she would try to call them in, and she took a little piece of rope and she tied a mackerel to her fin and then swam around with that attached to her. Then a little 4-foot mako shark came over to check her out, and that was cool. And we were like, yeah, cool. And then a couple of blue sharks came in and we were like, yeah, yeah, yeah. And by that time, you know, we'd been in the water a little while, and it's Southern California. And so the water is like 60 degrees. We're all pretty cold. So we get out and everybody's kind of warming up and everything like that. And we're like, yeah, yeah, that was cool. That was cool. And we look out toward the horizon and we see one of these mako sharks fully clearing the water, like jumping out of the water, like something very, very large is chasing it. And we're like, uh-oh, I'm glad we got out of the water. This point, I don't want to meet whatever is chasing a 6-foot mako shark. And we never did actually find out what it was, but there were large great whites that would come through there on a regular basis and everything. And fortunately, nobody got their leg chewed off by doing this, but in retrospect, a very bad idea.
Mommy shark.
Has anyone since then tied off a bait fish to their equipment and swam around with it?
Not that I know of.
My field crew gets excited about 18-inch brown trout.
My other shark story here, this one was in the eastern Gulf of Mexico. I was on a research cruise. It was trapping for groupers and snappers in an area of the eastern Gulf of Mexico called the Florida Middle Grounds. And it's kind of a big reef area, 50 miles offshore. We're out there. We did all our trapping all day long and everything. And we anchored up in this nice spot that people wanted to fish. And so it's nighttime. It's like 9, 10 o'clock. It's pitch black. You know, we got deck lights on and everything. Everybody's like, yeah, let's go fishing. We're going to catch some snappers. And so everybody puts their lines in. I put a line in. It seems like something grabs it, but it doesn't really run. I'm like, that's weird. It feels like it's caught. It feels like it's a fish and not a rock. But like, you know, you get caught on a rock and you're like, I got something huge. Oh my God, it's huge. And it's, you're just fighting a rock for 2 hours. I hook up and I'm like, duh, it's shaking its head. It's definitely a fish. I know it's a fish. And so, but it's not going anywhere. It's not coming up. I can't get any traction out of it at all. You know, I'm trying. I'm looking around at all the guys on the deck because I think I'm the only girl on the boat too. And I'm looking around. I'm like, what did you guys do? Are you guys pranking me? What's happening right now? No. It's a fish. And I reel a little bit and then it takes a huge, it finally runs. It takes this huge run and takes all this line out. I'm like, come on. I reel. I get a little bit more. It takes another huge run, a couple more times, 45 minutes. Finally, it gets close enough to the surface for me to see. It is a 6 foot long sand tiger shark. Nondescript gray brownie guy that has these like snaggly teeth all sticking out all over its face, gets up to where I can see it, looks me in the eye and shakes its head and just takes off and breaks the line.
He was just playing a game with you there.
He totally was. He was such a lazy shark.
Daddy shark.
So my story is from when I used to work on coral reefs. I actually worked on invertebrates for a while before I worked in fisheries. And this is a pretty funny field story. So I did a lot of field surveys where we would identify our sponges by species based on their physical characteristics underwater. Then we would take samples back to the lab to verify using their skeletal components that that's what species they actually were. So one day I was doing some sample collection down in the Keys and I came across this big bunch of sponges, and right in the middle was a size, texture, and color of sponge I had never seen before. It was gray and smooth, right in the middle of a pile of rough orange and yellow sponges. And I thought, either this is a species we've never seen in the Keys, or it's migrated in from elsewhere. Maybe its range has shifted. And so I went to take a sample of it. And as I reached down to begin to take a sample of this sponge, the sponge turned around and it looked at me. And if you know anything about sponges, one of their main features is that they don't have organs, so they can't look at you. And I was surprised, and then the sponge got up and swam away. And at that moment, I realized it was not a sponge. It was a baby nurse shark sitting in the middle of the sponges that I was measuring. And we hadn't found a sponge that we hadn't seen on our study site before. In fact, it was a shark. So that's the story of how I almost picked up a very small nurse shark while I was in the field sampling sponges.
Baby shark, baby shark, baby shark.
Growing up in South Carolina, I've caught a few different species of shark. Nick, did you catch any sharks in Kansas this year?
No, not in Kansas. The only thing I've caught in Kansas here is a handful of white crappie the other day. Just taking advantage of the beautiful weather we had a few days ago, doing some quarantine crappie fishing. when I was fishing my first spot, I was sitting there and it's right where you go around this bend to get up in this arm, and further up the arm is pretty shallow. So not too many people go up there, although the catfish go up there in the shallows. But when I launched, there was this crappy pontoon with some sketchier looking people launching, and their boat had died right after they launched. And so they were trying to motor it back to shore in case they had to load it back up. You're just cussing and kicking at this thing. He finally gets it going and they put off to wherever they're fishing. I'm fishing for a few hours and these guys, I can hear them across the lake, and they'd start motoring my way. And I think, oh, they're going to come steal my spot. They anchor up within earshot and eye shot, so I could see everything they were doing. And they throw out their minnow rigs and everything for crappie. And one of the girls on the boat started catfishing. And sure enough, within like 5 minutes, she starts reeling it in and she yells a blue cat. In my lake, reservoir has blue cats, but we have a 35-inch minimum trying to get a population started. So I was surprised that she actually got one so quick without really seeming like she was trying. And so she started reeling this thing up, and it was well beneath the 35-inch minimum. But she started looking around the boat, pulled out a stringer, and strung this thing up on a stringer and set it on the side of the pontoon boat. And then threw her line back out, and 5 minutes later had another blue cat. Being the wildlife parks employee I am, I was looking through my phone. I didn't have my work phone. I was looking through my personal one, seeing if I had the game warden's numbers. And I kind of started to realize, oh, they're probably not going to launch their boat and come write these guys a ticket. So I just ignored them, and I thought, oh, maybe I'll say something when I motor off. And I didn't want to start anything. So then when I got back, after I kept my few fish, I went up to my office, grabbed a regulation book, circled Perry Lake in the regulations and highlighted the blue catfish part and underlined the minimum length limit and stuck it on their windshield. They were one of three trucks in the parking lot when I got there. Hopefully the wind kept it on their truck and didn't blow it off.
Did they stock blue catfish?
We stocked them in from 2007 to 2012, or somewhere in that ballpark. There are a few catfish tournaments that do fish it, and they say that it's starting to come on, and pretty soon it'll be just as good as the other reservoirs in the state, but I'm still crossing my fingers on that one. If it's that easy to catch them, I need to start doing it more often. Because I'd been going out to Milford trying to get some, and one of the other biologists was there, and he goes over all the time, and he sets his rods up, and he casts out, and he gets fish left and right. I had mine set up, didn't get a single thing the whole time I was there. And every time I've gone, he just keeps pulling fish in left and right. I've concluded it's just he has a little bit longer fishing poles than I do. He can get his bait out just a little bit further than I can.
You got to tell yourself something.
It's never the fisherman's fault. It's always something else.
No. You weren't holding your mouth, right?
In grad school, we were a little bit superstitious. I mean, the people say don't bring a banana in the boat. We never checked lunch boxes or anything. We were more, our thing was, you never put water in the boat until you have a fish, like until you know you have a fish coming. So like when we were running nets, you would never start dumping water into the live well until you pulled the net up and saw, oh, we're going to have a paddle fish or we're going to have a sturgeon on the trout line. Start filling that live well up.
I think I've done that a few times. My master's was all about catching red drum and don't put any water in until you know there's a fish.
Yeah, there'd be days where the day before we had great day catching loads of fish, and then the next day, different help. He started filling the live well up before we pulled a net in. Seth, you jinxed us. We're not going to catch any fish. We maybe got like a quarter of the fish we had the day before.
Hey, this is Noah Breastman calling with, as requested, a fishing story. This is the time I accidentally took a bunch of National Geographic explorers fishing at 2 a.m. in the Potomac River. So I was on Twitter getting ready for the first International Snakehead Symposium to present my snakehead research in D.C. when I saw somebody, Joe Cutler, tweeted out that he is going to be in D.C. and looking for recommendations on people to take him, like charter guides, to take him fishing for blue catfish at the Potomac River, or perhaps spot recommendations. And he's a fish biology, fishery scientist at UC Santa Cruz. And I was like, well, I'll actually be there for a separate conference from him, planning to fish blue catfish anyway with like 10 rods. You can come if you want. And so he's like, awesome. Do you mind if 20 National Geographic explorers also come? including Zeb Hogan, the host of Monster Fish, the show I grew up watching, and the person that I probably want to take fishing most. And I was like, absolutely, I'll do that. So first I met up with them at a National Geographic seminar thing where basically they gave me free fancy cocktails and food, and I heard a bunch of cool people talk about cool things. And I talked to them about my research for about an hour on Sitka. And then later on, at like around midnight, I met up with them at the Potomac River at midnight in like a super muddy, swampy area where we kept seeing tons of snakes. We had 20 people around, and because it's National Geographic, a bunch of them had crazy cameras with them. And we were doing photo shoots with the fish we were catching and all the snakes was going on. And I did a photo shoot with Zeb Hogan with our fishing rod chest deep in the water at 2 a.m. with some like giant catfish and some shad. And it was a great time. Gave him some of my artwork, which was cool. And then I realized that I had to go back to a hotel with a cooler filled with fish. And so at 3 a.m. I was like, screw it. I'm just going to throw out this fish in the hallway trash can because there's no hose outside. I had to clean my bloody gut fish cooler in the hotel shower. So I feel bad for whoever had that room after me.
I am little fish swimming in the sea for me. Hello, 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 fish. Red fish, blue fish. Yellow fish, spiky fish, soft fish, happy fish, grumpy fish, one fish, two fish, three fish, all of the fishes. Unfish fish, still fish, spiky fish, scary fish, high fish, shy fish, flat fish, thin fish, thin, thin, thin fish. Crazy whirly fish. Crazy twirly fish. Upside down fish. Round and round. So many friends. So many fish. Boss, best fish. Which one is the best? Even more than all the rest. Hello, Mom.
Hello, little fish.
Kissy, kissy. Hooray for fish.
Everywhere else I'd been, in Iowa and Missouri, our electro fishing boats were like, you have the magic box and then you have the homemade wired boat set up with different configurations of fiberglass booms and all that. So when I got to Kansas, I had an actual Smith Root built boat. And I thought, man, this is going to be sweet. And I was so excited to use it, but I had to wait because I got hired in the fall. So I had to wait till the spring to actually use this thing. When I started, the boat was already 20 years old, and I thought, man, this has to be one of the older ones in the state, but I was still excited about running a Smith Root built boat. And so I get out, and I did maybe three or four lakes. I was doing another lake, had a city volunteer helping me out, and turned the boat on and wasn't getting any juice and started playing with settings, and all of a sudden the thing just sparks, like a visible spark. I thought, oh crap, I did something wrong. I thought, oh, that's all right, the guy helping me, he's an electrician, he'll be able to tell me something. So we open it up, take it apart to get to the guts of it. Thing was just black. And we were like, yeah, we probably messed something up pretty good here. So that ended my first electrofishing season. You take that thing out to ship it off. It's got like wires and you can see the guts and stuff. So I carried that into a FedEx location and set it on the counter and said, I need to ship this. So I didn't have a box to put it in. And they just like looked at me like, what the hell is this? Is this a time machine or something? They didn't ask any other questions, but I still had some lakes to do them. One of them was my big reservoir that gets a lot of bass tournaments, and so I thought I need to try to sample this. But we don't just have an extra electrofishing boat laying around in the state, so I had to wait for another biologist to finish up. So then he drops his boat off at my office, and his boat is like 6 years older than mine. So this thing's like 30 years old by now. Most of them have a steering wheel now. Before that, they had a rudder arm instead of a steering wheel, and it was all the way down or all the way up was your steering from right to left, like trying to go to Britain and drive it on the other side of the road, or
I used to run mullet fishing boats. We're netting out the back of our boats in the estuaries. And so the engine on one of those is basically in the front. In South Carolina, we ran them with a tiller. So you're driving a tiller drive boat from the front, which means you have to do it backwards from what you would normally do with a tiller.
That's different. I can just imagine Nick in the UPS store like, hey, I need to put this large burnt up electrical box and ship it to Oregon. Whatever, man, if you're paying for it.
Baby.
So in Kansas, I collect sauger instead of walleye. And so then my job throughout the spring is to squeeze sauger and make the sauger milk for making sauguy. We ship some of that to Colorado. In the first 2 or 3 years I was here, we squeezed it all at my office. We had a building we kept all the sauger in. But the first year, my boss, supervisor, he took the sperm and he took it to FedEx or shipped it off to Colorado. So I didn't get to experience any of that. But the second year, he left it up to me to do that. So we squeezed all our fish. We had the 30 or 40 vials of sperm that we were shipping them. And so we load it into the special egg box filled with ice. You know, I drive it into Topeka to take it to the FedEx and set it up on the counter. Tell them I need to ship this to Colorado overnight. And they ask what it is. And I say, well, it's fish sperm. Don't even bat an eye. And they say, do you need it insured? No, if it doesn't make it there, it's ruined.
What is this? Oh, it's fish sperm. Oh, great.
Of course.
Do you need it insured? Oh, of course. Well, I knew that, I guess.
Is it liquid or perishable? Yes.
Ready. So I'll say. Okay. Hi, Chelsea Crandall here with my new colleagues.
What's your name? Keith.
And? That's my name. What's your name?
Mango.
Ross, also known as Mango. Hello from quarantine. Do you boys want to tell a fish story?
Mm-hmm.
What's your fish story?
My fish story is about when someone's fish just went away.
Oh, that's a good story. What's your favorite fish?
My favorite fish is a red fish.
My favorite fish is a fish shaped like a donut.
A fish shaped like a donut. That's a good fish.
And he saw the big moon, the sky up, and he decided he wanted to go fishing. And then, so he got his fishing pole and his net, then set off and went and ran across the fields, ran across the valleys, over the mountains, the hills, and the forest, and in the jungle, and then until he reached the dock, and it was a fishing dock, and he walked on toward it, and then cast, and then he caught a fish, and he reeled it in, but then he jumped off, and then went away, and he said, oh no, what am I gonna do? But he had an idea.
What was his idea?
His idea was to see when he had to, when fishing, he tried again. Then he caught one, then, see? It didn't jump away, then he put it in the net. And it was a bass.
A bass? That's a good
then
story, buddy.
Then he started to cast again and caught a trout. Then he caught a huge red fish.
Whoa. That's a good story.
But then,
before
he put him in the bucket, he just fell down.
He fell down? That was a good fall you just did.
He fell to the water, and then he said, hey, I flip-flopped.
Oh.
I didn't fall in the water. I was on the dock, and this dock had a fence.
That's a funny story. Let's let Ross tell a story now.
Once upon a time, there was a little dog named Bell, and he said it to a fishing boat. He had no fishing boat, no net, and no bucket.
No.
But he cried, oh no, what did I do? But he did some, and no fishing boat. There's no more fishes!
No more fishes? What did he do?
He cried. Oh. He made a coconut to help.
Oh, we got a coconut to help?
Yeah.
I'd put out ultrasonic receivers, the Vimco V2s. So basically like a $1,000 receiver that you throw in the water with the idea of being able to reacquire it and get all the information off of there. I'd put them out in relatively known locations in Charleston Harbor. You know, they had a float on them, got GPS coordinates because I was a grad student and these things were worth more than I was. And so we had them in the spots. We're going to them, downloading with you know, normal frequency, no issues. And then one day looked out at the harbor and the beach view nourishment people had stashed some of their stuff inside right by the lab where one of the stations was. And I was looking, I was like, man, that looks really, really close to where my receiver was. Drove a small boat out, drive around, can't see the float. No, I'm wrong. I'm just going to get out the GPS. I'm pretty sure I know where this is, but I'm probably wrong. And the GPS is going to tell me where it actually is. And so the GPS is like, yep, this thing is immediately underneath this enormous barge. And so I got the number for the beach renourishment company, called them, and they're like, yeah, we can park wherever we want. And I was like, yeah, but you parked right on top of some scientific equipment. It was not their highest priority. And then I finally sweet talked them into moving it. And they're like, yeah, we'll move it. You can go out and do it and look for it tomorrow. Because they also didn't want me roaming around their stuff. If we got too close to their very expensive beach renourishment equipment, then we get in trouble. So we go out after they've moved it. It's kind of like braille diving. So you can see stuff. You can usually figure out which way is up, but the visibility is definitely less than a meter. So we go to where it should be and we drop down and do a circle search and are feeling around trying to find like pieces of it. And the whole time you're kind of braille diving around and you're hearing these clicks, and then a full-size adult dolphin is doing strafing runs trying to figure out what we're doing. So you're sitting there, you know, we're looking around for it. The whole time you're hearing, you know, clicks and then feeling like the pressure wake of a grown dolphin buzzing by you. We searched until we ran out of air, lost all the data from like the last 2 months before they parked their barge on it.
Yeah, and I thought temp loggers were bad.
You know, but is that sinking feeling you look out and you're less like, oh, that looks awfully close to where some of my stuff is. You know, yeah, just living in denial, driving up to it like, no, we're going to find it. It's going to be right next to it. And I'm sure tugboat moving that barge around probably just picked up the buoy, the line, and the I-beam base that it was on and probably just chewed it up into little bits and then spit it back out.
Now, when I was in Southeast Missouri, we had Vimco receivers on the Mississippi River, and so much fluvial movement moving around, you can't just have an anchored base because they'd get buried in sand. So the people before me there, oh, we'll get permission from DOT and we'll mount these on the back of bridge pillars. So going up the river, they have two on each bridge. They just drill them into the back of the bridge pillars, these PVC pipes, and slide the VR2s down. And we'd always go and we'd download them, and that's no big worry. You just butt the boat up against it and pull the thing out through one of the windows. They have like six windows going up and down this pipe that you can pull the VR2 out of. When we were downloading, I would usually be driving the boat and I'd think, man, this must be some feat to put these things up on a bridge. And then one spring after high water event, one of those pipes actually got ripped off a bridge. So we had to go put one up. The top supervisor at the time, he was the one that had experience doing it. So he throws an extension ladder in the boat and a generator and all the tools that he's going to need to drill into the bridge and mount these things. And we get going. And this is the first bridge up at the junction of the Mississippi and the Ohio River. So it's quite a bit of barge traffic between the two. And so we're sitting there and we nose up against the bridge. And it's one thing with the current of the Mississippi River ripping past the bridge, kind of pushing the boat side to side as you're nosing against the bridge. But then to have someone up 10, 15 feet up on a ladder, drilling a pipe in, and while you're trying to hold the boat steady, barge ended up coming. So we had to scurry down the ladder and we had to go sit somewhere else while the barge passed. And one time we were up on the Missouri River sampling behind this dike, doing larval tows. And later in the summer, we also had a surface trawl that we were using. And so we were messing around doing one of those behind this wing dike on the Missouri River. The carp like to hang out behind the dikes because it's slack water. a silver carp jumped up, arching right towards me as I was driving the boat. So I kind of leaned out of the way. And sure enough, this thing lands right on the throttle in gear, and I wasn't wearing the kill switch. So the boat lurches forward, and we all fly back in the seats. Learned a lesson, wear the kill switch when you're in carp waters. You never know where those things are going to land. At least in my experience, if you're the only boat in the water and you're on plane, they usually can't react fast enough to get you. It's usually if you're just putting around that they can jump and hit you in the boat, or if you're following another boat. Yeah, we've had some where we've been putzing along fast enough for them to jump and hit the boat, and they dart off. And we had one that flew right between two people sitting in the back of the boat and hit the outboard and knocked itself out cold, dead, just laying in the back of the boat. And it was a good, like, 18-inch silver carp.
He really left it all out there. Wanted to make a name for himself.
You win, buddy.
That's the end of doo-doo. That's the end of doo-doo. That's the end.
Thank you so much for listening. I want to remind everyone that we do now have a Patreon page for the show. So if you feel so inclined, head on over to patreon.com and search Fisheries Podcast to check it out. If you would like to get a hold of me, you can find me on Twitter at FishVecchio. The podcast is at Fisheries Pod. You can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast or old-fashioned email feedback@thefisheriespodcast.com. Remember to send in those stories. I hope that you enjoyed this episode. You can download and subscribe to receive future episodes on your favorite listening app, or stream it from Spotify or thefisheriespodcast.com. I'm Julie Vecchio. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Fisheries Podcast. And remember, always have fun.